Hello, this is A Country Breakfast. I'm Edwina Farley. How do you feel about your food being picked, packed and sorted by a team of illegal workers, often underpaid, overworked and abused?
I think it's a sad indictment on our industry, and it doesn't reflect the real farming community. In every business anywhere, you're going to have people that are going to exploit people. And this time it looks like some of the farmers, whether they know it or not.
And we'll head to Australia's beef capital to meet the next generation of farmers. First though, a look at the week in rural news with Tony Allen. And Tony, illegal farm workers caught the government's attention this week as well.
Yes, well, it was all started by the Four Corners report on Monday night, revealing exploitation of some foreign workers. Some were underpaid, some were even sexually harassed, and it was pretty sad stuff and pretty upsetting stuff. And very few in the industry have questioned what Four Corners alleged. It seems more of an admission that this does happen and it's time to start stamping it out. The federal government, for its part, has condemned what it saw on Four Corners too. And one of the things the government is pushing for is changes to make it mandatory for young visitors on working holiday visas to produce pay slips when they apply to renew their visas for a second year. That's to prove they weren't being exploited. There are other ideas, which I'll mention shortly, that came from the horticulture industry. But overall, the government is saying it still has confidence in the 457 and the 417 migrant worker visa programs. There is a need for the labour, and the government is not going to back down on those programs, but it wants to reform them. And Mr. Joyce says the Assistant Minister for Immigration, Michaela Cash, will be responsible for that reform of the visa system.
We'll be over this one like a rash, and Michaela Cash is just the right person. She has clearly expressed her disgust with this. We want to attract people into our nation for these 457, 417 visa processes. This neither helps us attracting them, nor does it help the farmers.
And the horticulture industry is proposing migrant workers be given a green card, a so-called green card by the Department of Immigration. A group called Voice of Horticulture has suggested this, and the chair of it, Tanya Chapman, says it would be a photo ID card that would have a smart chip in it with information that farmers and workers could check with a mobile phone.
As migrant workers come into regions, they will have already had an induction of sorts. So they will have the basic understanding of OH&S. They will have been ticked off that they have the correct working visas, tax file numbers, superannuation, and all of that information will be stored on a green card.
Having a look at other news now, and it's a sort of dreary time, I guess you could say, and a bit depressing, certainly, for anyone involved in lamb production.
Yes, the lamb industry is in a bad way at the moment, although they do think their future is pretty secure. But at the moment, there's not much lamb around, partly because of drought in parts of Australia and because there's not much international demand on the market, which is a contrast with beef, where Australian beef is booming. This week, Australia's biggest meat processor, JBS Australia, stood 260 factory staff down, announced it would halve lamb production at its meatworks at Bordertown in South Australia and Brooklyn in Melbourne. And Richard Harvey from the Rural Marketing Agents Association expects that several other meat processors will do the same soon.
I can see processors having extended shutdowns. But the only ramifications of that for them, you know, we've got to look at the big picture here. Your workforce element is a very big factor. And if they are long-term shutdowns, people just move and go to another job or another work somewhere else where they can keep the cash flow going. Because in that meat industry, they don't get paid if they're not working.
An interesting story about processed mushrooms, which we don't tend to have anymore, but there was an issue about them at some point.
Yes, if you like those shiitake mushrooms or whatever that are dried out or whatever.
Or your champignon tin.
Yes, they might be a little bit cheaper soon because the Australian Anti-Dumping Commission is going to remove the tariff on preserved mushrooms imported from China. And there's a little backstory to this because It's sad that mushroom processing in Australia no longer exists. The last mushroom cannery, Windsor Farms in New South Wales, went into liquidation in 2013, and that was 8 years after Windsor Farms and the Mushroom Growers Association spent $400,000 persuading the authorities to whack a 5% anti-dumping tariff on processed mushrooms from China. Now an importer has applied for the tariff to end because Australia no longer produces any preserved mushrooms or any mushrooms in brine.
No, all those funny ones in butter sauce. Yeah, you don't see a lot of it, really. To Victoria now, and some big news. I feel like we've talked about this story for decades now, grazing in Victoria's national parks.
Yes, there's been movement at the station, and according to the new Victorian Labor government, alpine grazing is banned forever in Victorian national parks. The coalition government, the previous one, did allow, controversially, cattle into the national parks for a trial. It argued that grazing the national parks could reduce the risk of bushfires, and they were testing that out. Now, a Labor bill has passed Victoria's upper house, which means it's now law, banning the scientific trials and thus stopping alpine grazing. But Jeff Borman from the Fishers and Shooters Party, which was one of the upper house parties that did oppose the ban, doesn't think the issue is closed.
Look, I don't think the alpine grazing debate will ever be over. Clearly, the coalition government had a different view to the current Andrews government. And at one point in time, just given the nature of politics, the coalition will end up back in power, and I suspect they might try and deal with it their way.
When it comes to welfare-oriented stories to do with animals, we're usually talking about industries trying to team up with welfare organisations or certainly defend themselves against them. A different approach from the dairy industry.
Yeah, the dairy industry said no to the advances of the RSPCA, which wanted an animal welfare-approved milk brand. The RSPCA wanted to develop a label for milk produced to welfare-friendly standards. But the president of Australian Dairy Farmers, the lobby group, Noel Campbell, says that would have divided the dairy industry.
We believe that a brand that was RSPCA labelled would indicate that any milk that was actually provided under another label had practices that were less than good practices for animal health and welfare. So therefore we believe that would distort the message. We need to have a brand that's Aussie dairy.
And that farmer power, if you like to call it, also has reared its head in the case of shearing.
Yes, we've spoken before about the campaign by the group PETA, or People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, against the shearing industry. Quite recently, PETA's campaign used a model holding a fake sheep covered in blood with the headline, "Here is the rest of your wool coat," and the aim of the campaign was to suggest that shearing was a cruel industry. Now, the farmers were the ones who noticed that it wasn't really a real sheep in the ad, and Victorian Farmers Federation President Peter Toohey said that using social media, which was then picked up by the major metropolitan media, the farmers exposed that fake image and they beat Peter at its own high-tech media game.
Farmers are seeing that, they're starting to learn how to do the tweeting stuff, and they're seeing the value of social media. So I think it's starting to grow, and they're seeing the value that when we get together collectively and use this social media, it engages the broader community and people understand what's going on. So we've got a voice.
And an interesting alignment, I guess you could say, between the Country Women's Association and medicinal marijuana.
Yes, the Country Women's Association has gone in recent years into much more controversial issues, and the old image of the CWA, there's still a bit of it around, but it's actually a pretty forward-thinking organisation. And the New South Wales branch of the CWA has passed two motions to support legalisation of medicinal marijuana. One motion called for its use in medical cases, and the other one called for it to be legal to grow, manufacture and distribute marijuana for medical purposes. And CWA Health Vice President Lois Starley says the understanding of medicinal cannabis has increased enormously in the 13 years since the CWA first debated the issue.
To see a motion like this come through and be carried so very successfully really does give weight to the argument that it is time to really consider making this medicinal marijuana freely available to those patients who need it. It's for medical reasons only.
And given that some state parliaments are also looking at the issue, it has become quite a mainstream and far less controversial issue than it used to be.
It's interesting. Tony, you can now devote the rest of your time to tweeting stuff.
Oh, non-stop.
As beautifully put before by Peter Toohey. Thank you, Tony. You can head online for the latest news, of course, at abc.net.au/rural.
On Background Briefing, homophobia in Australian sport.
There's no doubt we have a problem.
It's rife from the bottom to the top.
It made me feel like, well, what have I been doing for the last 10 years representing Australia when the attitude is it'd be better if I just leave?
And it's stopping many people from playing at all.
70% youth under 22 believe that sports are not safe or welcoming for lesbian, gay and bisexual people.
You can download this Background Briefing from the RN website.
You're listening to RN. Edwina Farley with you. Time to hit the road with our rural reporters. This week, the Flying Doctor is in Oodnadatta, with the special women's-only GP clinic in action. And speaking of women, a group of ladies in Broken Hill in the far west of New South Wales gets the good oil on basic car care. And we try our hand at basket weaving. While we're talking about being crafty, you get to meet an enterprising sheep farmer who's enlisted the help of local hand knitters to set up an online business, selling children's woolen clothes and jumpers.
They're amazing. It's such a wonderful group. They're all either wool growers or they have close associations with wool growers anyway, so they certainly, yeah, we're very, quite passionate about being part of it.
The story behind the Wool with Love brand a little later, but first stop today, Oodnadatta, in the far north of South Australia, where the Royal Flying Doctor Service plane has just landed.
We basically are the GP service for many of these outback communities. So many people are aware of the emergency service that RFDS provides, but very few are aware of the regular GP primary care clinics and women's health clinics that we provide, which is to try to decrease the emergencies out there. And very critical, we all think it's nothing to go down the street and see a GP, but that is not an option if you live in these communities.
For most of us, it's pretty easy to make an appointment to visit the doctor for a checkup. But for people living in rural and remote areas of Australia, access to even the most basic of health services can be a real problem. Hello, I'm Caroline Winter. The Royal Flying Doctor Service is renowned for its emergency retrieval service across Australia, but that's not all it does. Increasingly, it's being called on to deliver primary healthcare services, and that's what's happening here today at Oodnadatta in the far north of South Australia. Dr. Betsy Williams and the team are running a special GP clinic just for women. It's been 3 years since a program like this has been held here, and women have come from around the town and the region for a checkup. Women like Christine Lennon.
This is the most women I've seen so far coming to one of these clinics, Women's Day. Not too many young ones come, but it's good to see a lot of the young ones here today.
Soon there isn't a spare seat in the waiting room at the Oodnadatta Clinic, and as the more than 30 women settle in, Dr. Betsy Williams gets started.
And as you know, we have to go inside the bottom and we open it up so we can see.
Using a booklet, she explains what's involved in a pap smear. It's something some of these women haven't had done for 10 years and a very worrying statistic.
Because we know that the incidence of cervical cancer in Aboriginal women is far higher than it is in white women, and that they do not get the same levels of services, and that they do not have the same lifespan. This is the closing the gap issue, where we're still dealing with close to 19 years age difference for age expectancy for women. And these are some of the reasons.
How often do you check this?
But today isn't just about pap smears.
Before or after eating?
Before eating,
and it's normally 11 in the morning, is it?
Mm.
Okay.
In another room, sleeves are being rolled up and blood glucose levels checked. Dr. Williams again.
One of the things that we also are discussing are things like diabetes and coronary artery disease. These are two of the major killers of women, particularly Aboriginal women, and to try and do something about weight control, sugar control, fat control, blood pressure control at this stage can prevent a lot of major heart disease and a lot of stroke. So it's very important done in this age group.
Christine Lennon is a 49-year-old mother of one and born and bred in Udnadatta. She's here because she knows the importance of maintaining good health.
I have been talking to dietitians and that because I'm a diabetic, and I'm proud of myself. I'm pleased because I'm somebody that isn't high or low or anything. I'm probably the perfect patient.
So can I ask how long you've been a diabetic and what changes you've made to try and address it?
For the last 10 years I have been, and I've managed to stay on the metformin tablets all this time. So I've never ever had to increase or go on insulin or anything like that. Blood pressure is perfect.
Diet and exercise are two factors that have given her the title of perfect patient. And as part of the clinic, it's something the group are also being taught.
Yeah, that's it. So you're using your biceps, so you're making your arms strong through here.
Amid the laughter, RFDS lifestyle advisor Denise O'Connell is showing the women how to stretch using big elastic bands.
So I want to get the women chatting and laughing and hopefully at the same time learning a few things about how to exercise or get a bit more incidental exercise and a bit of exposure to healthy eating and what that looks like rather than preaching to them about what it is. It's more about showing them what it is.
Soon a spread of salad, cold meat and cheese is laid out on the table for everyone to make healthy wraps. It's about the only time the waiting room falls silent during the day, and it's a silence that brings music to the ears of Alison Day, RFDS Healthy Services Program Manager.
While we do these programs in these remote locations, we don't always get the feedback about what impact we have. So to have a day that's focused on these sorts of, particularly on women's health issues, where we have the opportunity to get the data from patients such as their blood pressures, their blood sugar levels, their weights, their waist circumferences, gives us really good information to be able to compare how those measurements have been in the past.
She says regular visits and holistic lifestyle programs like this are vital in trying to close the gap in Indigenous disadvantage.
Well, certainly it's well known that Indigenous people live at least 10 years less on average than non-Indigenous people. Also, their access to health services is not as regular, and they often have a much higher incidence of chronic disease and heart conditions and those sorts of preventable often diseases and conditions that are really a result of less regular access to health care.
After 8 hours, dozens of pap smears, blood glucose checks, food education and a whole lot of laughter, this team of dedicated women leave this remote town and its residents now more informed, more health conscious and with smiles on their faces.
Look, if they're too tight to undo, well then you've got to call someone to help you because...
Hi, I'm Heather. I've come here tonight to learn how to look after my car because my husband won't let me drive to Mildura without knowing how to change a tyre. So it's really informative for me. It's been good.
If they're too tight for you to undo, don't do yourself an injury and try it. Persevere, get someone to give you a hand.
Hi, I'm Gigi and I just participated in the Women for Drive workshop and I found it really interesting.
Just wind the wheel nuts on.
Do you check the oil before heading off on a long road trip? What about topping up the water for the windscreen wipers? And can you change a tyre? Hello, I'm Cherie von Hirschner, and like the other women around me tonight, I'm now much better informed about basic car maintenance than I was just a couple of hours ago. And that's pretty important when you live in the remote far west of New South Wales, often hundreds of kilometres from a friendly mechanic. There's about 25 of us here tonight in Arthur Clifton's garage in Broken Hill, ranging in age from 16 to 75, all keen to learn what's under the bonnet.
Well, I'm just trying to teach them the basics of keeping a car on the road and not having to abandon it if there's any need to, sort of thing. Really, yeah, trying to teach them what could you say, the right way of going about things rather than panicking and leaving their car and sort of putting themselves in danger of walking away from it, yeah.
So what are some of the questions that have been asked tonight?
Mainly about where the oil goes and how do you put the oil in and brake fluid, water for the radiator and also water for your window washers. They get a bit worried about how their tyres are wearing or how much tread's left on them. And we supply them with a tread depth gauge, a little cardboard tread depth gauge, and that seems to allay their fears because they know they've got a fair way to go or they haven't got so far to go on their tyres yet.
So far, what have you been learning?
About wheel alignments. And I didn't know that they put little balances in the wheels. I thought they actually put it on a machine and shook it up to make it even. But so each wheel was like in the right position, balancing, yeah. They put these little weights in the rims. Yeah, that was really interesting to me.
And what else are you hoping to learn tonight?
How to change the tyre so I can go to Mildura shopping.
We even went under a car, which I'd never done in my life before. It was fascinating. Everyone should have a look at what a car looks like from underneath that, yeah.
And do you, when you go driving, do you head out bush much in your car?
I don't do so much bush driving, but I do long distance driving a lot. And as a woman, you do feel sometimes the stretches are so long. If anything happened, you know, would I be able to cope? And so tonight was really useful in that it gave me more confidence.
Hi, I'm Abby. I came here tonight to learn a bit on how to look after my car.
Before you came tonight, did you have any idea on how to change a tyre?
No, I didn't know how to change my tyre before I came here.
Hi, I'm Belle. I've came here tonight to learn more about my car and the servicing side of things. It's all been pretty interesting so far and, yeah, it's good help.
How long have you been driving for?
5 years. Yeah. Yeah, no, I have learned a few things tonight that I didn't actually know about, which was good.
Like what?
Just a lot more about the tyres, what they're made out of, that they're actually tubeless. I thought they had tubes in them. Your tyre pressure, actually. I learned about what your tyre pressure should be, which is good because I'm always ringing up my brother-in-law asking him what my tyre pressure should be.
It can be put on the left side of the car, the right side of the car, front or rear.
Hi, I'm Geraldine. I came along tonight to pick up a few hints on things to get me out of difficulties when I'm driving because I drive along away sometimes on my own. Yes, I've learned tonight how to get myself out of mischief if I do have any problems on the road.
What stood out for you were a couple of things that were very important?
I think weather conditions. They gave us a few hints on weather conditions and what to do when we're driving, for our tyre care. Safety, a few safety tips that I wouldn't have thought of had I even been changing a tyre.
Like what?
Well, the chocks, using like under the alternate tyres. We could use rocks in like an outback situation on the road. Yeah, and just basically being aware of keeping our car in good order, checking a few simple things every couple of weeks. Yes, it's good.
Geraldine, one of the women participating in that special car maintenance course in Broken Hill. Cherie Van Horschner, our reporter there, getting her hands dirty, changing those tyres. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, the knitting needles are working overtime in southern New South Wales, and a basket weaving workshop helps bind a community together in Victoria.
It's traditional basket weaving. We use the grass off the land and there's no needles or anything involved, so, yeah, we're teaching these girls how to do a bit of traditional weaving.
So what we're doing is winding that around.
Yeah. Oh, but not as thickly. Okay.
About 20 women and children sit in a circle watching carefully as local Gunai woman Susan Martin demonstrates the art of basket weaving. She's winding the grass into an intricate pattern that will, in time, form a basket. G'day, I'm Laura Poole in the Goongra Community Hall in Victoria's East Gippsland. This is one of the state's most remote communities. It takes more than an hour of driving down the very windy Bonang Highway to get to the shops at Orbost.
So to get all of these people together in the one place at the one time for a basket weaving workshop is a major achievement. So what's the grass called that you use?
Lamandra. In our language we call it barn. That's a Ganai language. And that grass is all around the paddocks and everywhere around farmlands, bush areas.
And where did you learn to basket weave?
An old lady from Lake Tyers Aboriginal Trust, Aunty Linda, she used to come around and we'd sit with her and she'd teach us how to do the traditional weaving, and she's passed away about 20 years ago, so we still carry it on.
And how often do you do it?
Well, every time I go camping or every time I feel bored, I pick it up like knitting needles, yeah.
And what do you like about it?
Oh, it's good. It's relaxing. I love it. I enjoy it. My mother, she used to do it with us, and we're teaching our younger ones to do it now, so the tradition stays there.
We're standing at Goongara in the mountains where you've been doing a workshop with about 20 women. Why do you think it's important to show other people how to do this?
It's a traditional piece of work, and we don't mind sharing our culture with everybody, because if we don't share our culture, then, you know, they won't have an understanding of what our people are all about. So.
And I've been having a go as part of the workshop. What do you think of my weaving?
No, you've done really well. Really.
That's not well. What you said before.
No, it's deadly. No, you've done a good... No, fair dinkum, serious. That is really good, considering, like, for beginners. I've seen others and, you'll pass.
And for the listeners, it's more like a coaster than a basket at the moment. It's just small. How long does it take you to build some of the big baskets that we traditionally use for fishing?
Just to start off with a basket, once you get your base where you want it, and then once you start bringing it up in a nice big basket, it takes about an hour to go around the basket. After you've got to think about gathering all the grass, drying it, cutting it, splitting it, then soaking it and then working with it. Well, how can you put that into money, dollars?
Yeah.
Time and effort. Yeah. It's hard.
So we'll go over the top.
Yeah. The high country around Goongara and neighbouring Tubbert was devastated by bushfires just over 12 months ago. More than 165,000 hectares was burnt out over 70 days. The fires have taken a toll on the local community, so workshops like this help bring everyone together.
Okay, I'm Lisa Camp and I work at the Tubbert Neighbourhood House as a coordinator.
And Lisa, I've just stolen you away from your basket weaving. What was today's workshop all about?
It was basically, like the Tubbert Neighbourhood House always does, is trying to get people together. And this is actually a breakthrough. It's the first time we've held a workshop in Goongara. And it's done more than we could imagine, because it's brought people from Delegat in New South Wales all the way up to Tubbert, and from Orbost and Marlow, which is just great. Mm.
And why is it important to come together?
Because we're so remote out here, and even our schools, it's Tubbert and Goongara School, and we're so far apart, we don't really catch up out of school, our children catch up. And just to keep it... communication going, and the conversations that have been happening out of today doing the basketry, you see everyone walking around and looking at other people's baskets and then having a great chat.
And it's been a really trying year or two for the region. I mean, we look out over the mountains and we can see the scar of the fire. Is it important now more than ever to be having continuous conversations as communities?
Yeah, look, I think it is. And when you go through that disaster that happens, it brings the community together. And we've seen it in a lot of other places. They come together, but then they start tearing apart again. It doesn't take long. So to keep us all together and to keep that communication going is such a big thing. And to be focusing on something other than fires for a change is really good.
I sort of imagined that they would tell me I had rocks in my head, to be honest. But they were so positive and enthusiastic about the idea, and yeah, they've been so wonderful.
Annabelle Scott's a country girl living with her husband and small children on a farm near Cootamundra in southern New South Wales. She's surrounded by beautiful merino sheep every day, but there was a problem. She couldn't find any good quality hand-knitted woolen clothes and jumpers for her young brood to wear. Hello, I'm Skye Manson. Not to be deterred, Annabelle had the idea of starting an online business. She enlisted the help of some local knitters, and with her marketing and advertising background, the Wool With Love brand was born.
We've got small children of our own now, and last year particularly, it was quite tricky just to come across a really good hand-knitted woolen jumper for our eldest boy, and we don't have anyone in our family who knits, and unless you've got a little craft shop in your local town or wherever, it can be hard to come by.
How many women have you got involved in it?
There are about 20, actually. They're amazing. It's such a wonderful group. They're all either wool growers or they have close associations with wool growers anyway, so they certainly, yeah, were very, quite passionate about being part of it.
How did you, what sense did you have that other people wanted woolen clothing in a similar way to how you did?
We had actually some friends staying down here from Sydney, and Jack was wearing a woolen jumper that he'd been given when he was born, and this was a little while ago, and they said, wow, where did you get that? If you could reproduce that, there could be such a market for it. And just a few friends had, just made passing comments that particularly hand-knitted stuff, but just good woolen clothing was hard to come by. So, and from my own experience as well, I just sort of thought, well, might be worth a go. And yeah.
On a personal level, has it been really nice to be involved with these women who are obviously from another generation of farming and are great knitters, but also, I don't know, women that have lived through a great lifetime on the land?
Yeah, absolutely, Skye. I feel so lucky to be involved with such an amazing group of women. They're such an inspiration, and they've just got so much to offer, twofold. They have this amazing skill of knitting, which is, there's not so many people around these days who have that skill, so that is incredible. And I just feel so fortunate to be involved with these inspirational women. I feel like I'm gaining probably a lot more out of the relationship than they are. They're just really, really beautiful women.
I've just finished having a cup of tea and a piece of cake with two of the beautiful women involved in the Wool With Love venture. Dee Bush lives on a farm near Bookham, and she was one of the first to get involved.
Annabelle rang me one day and said, Dee, remember those trousers you knitted for Jack when he was born? And I said, oh, yes. And she said, well, look, I've been trying to look for hand-knitted clothes for the children, and I can't seem to find them anywhere or what I want. And she said, I've got an idea of setting up a business. I said, oh, that's a great idea. And she said, where do I start? And is there any chance of getting some knitters? Do you know any knitters? And I said, oh, I think that's a wonderful idea, and I will try for you. And so that was how it all started. We organised some patterns, so we had to design and work out the sizes, and then we knitted some trial ones for her, and that is how we got knitting. And so she has now the business, and she tells us what to do, and it's so nice.
Well, Judy Ticehurst is also here. She's another one of the knitters from the Bookham clan, and you've got a really great story, Judy, of how you carried out your trial and error of the sizings with your grandchildren.
Yes, our family came to visit one weekend, and we had jumpers and skirts made, not quite sure on the sizes, but our grandchildren covered most of the ears, so we lined the children up one after the other and tried the clothes on them so we knew a size 2 fitted the 2-year-old and so on.
Yeah. And what is it that you enjoy about it?
Well, I love the socialising. I mean, I love the knitting, but our month 6 weekly get-togethers when we exchange ideas and have a coffee, or we run short of wool and we ring the neighbour, have you a little bit more red or blue? And it's a community effort, not just you knitting on your own.
Yeah. Would you have that kind of regular contact were it not for Wool With Love?
I would with near neighbours, but some of the others I wouldn't. Yeah. They're only people you see down the street when you go to town. But No, it's a different association with people. Neighbours you talk to about sheep or other things, but now it's knitting and wool as well.
Yeah. And Dee, is it something that you're happy to keep doing for a number of years to come?
Certainly is, because it is a very relaxing thing to do, and we get some pocket money along the way. It's just so nice to be able to do it. None of us are in it to make a fortune. We're just happy to do it for Annabelle.
Dee Bush from Bookham in southern New South Wales, one of the hand knitters involved in Annabelle Scott's Wool with Love venture. Sky Manson, the reporter there. I'm Edwina Farley. This is A Country Breakfast on RN. Now, in a moment, we'll hear an early call out for some extra cash from next week's federal budget. And we'll find out what farmers make of this week's Four Corners program that lifted the lid on illegal workers in the food industry.
On the Media Report podcast, two journalists covering a big court case finish their day's work, go to the pub and talk about what's been going on. That's the simple idea behind Finish Line, a podcast about the trial of the Boston Marathon bomber Zhahar Zanayev, which is going on at the moment. It doesn't sound that promising, but the result is brilliantly compelling. And the two reporters behind it are on the Media Report. There's also a look at commercial radio news, which has been going through some big changes. You can listen anytime at RN Online.
But first, the sabres have begun rustling, or should I say the bottles clinking, as the federal budget looms large on next week's horizon. The Winemakers Federation wants a multi-million dollar funding boost to the nation's statutory wine authority, Wine Australia. That's the group that does all the marketing for the wine industry. They say because the dollar is sitting below 80 cents, there's an uptick in American demand and the signing of free trade deals in Asia, the Federation argues it's time for extra promotional activities overseas. But Chief Executive Paul Evans told Clint Jasper that at the moment, Wine Australia doesn't have enough money for the extra programs needed to take advantage of what he says is a limited window of opportunity.
Well, they're doing as best a job as they can, but the resources available to them pale into insignificance compared to what we're competing against. Last year, France alone received some 140 million euros to do a similar job that we're asking Wine Australia to do with $5 or $6 million. That's the problem we face. And if we are to have a meaningful presence in wine shows, if we are to launch comprehensive in-market programs in North America, for example, seize the opportunity created by the China market, then we simply need more horsepower and funding. And that's the case that we've been putting to government.
Moving to some of the debate that's happening around the wine equalisation tax, when was your body made aware that changes to the rebate given to New Zealand producers, or any talk of that, would be pushed back to the White Paper review?
We've been talking to the government now for some 18 months on the need to abolish the separate New Zealand rebate scheme. A industry delegation of wine industry leaders went to Canberra on Monday, and we had a very constructive meeting with the Assistant Treasurer, but it became clear on the day that our proposals for wet rebate reform, including the removal of the rebate off bulk and unbranded wine, would now be referred to a separate discussion paper process. And we understand that that discussion paper will be released in July.
Were you disappointed to learn that South Australian Senator Sean Edwards had been making comments to Treasurer Joe Hockey that weren't in line with what the industry was wanting out of this reform process?
I think the vast majority of industry was disappointed to hear that. There is some confusion, and it's not clear as to why the Senator's view has prevailed against what is a clear majority and unprecedented level of industry unity around making these changes.
Are you worried in the whole process of putting the wine equalisation tax and the rebate out there for debate that you might end up with some changes that you don't want?
Well, look, we've got a very compelling case for government that has supporting expert legal and modelling advice. It has unanimous support from state wine associations, many regions, many individual winemakers, the Federation itself, and the peak national grape grower organisation. This has been a body of work that has been in train now for well over 2 years, and we believe that we are very strongly positioned to shape the government's thinking on these issues. No doubt others will have their say, and that's only right and proper. But again, we believe that we have a very, very strong argument to government to get on with reform.
Critics inside and outside of the industry of the rebate say that this tax rebate is a very inefficient way of boosting regional employment, which is what it's supposed to do. So if $45 million of this rebate is going offshore anyway, aren't there better ways of boosting regional employment?
The original intent of this rebate was to support wine businesses in the regional communities that they operate in, and clearly it is delivering that. It is playing a very, very important role for supporting branded wine producers out there in the regions. Unfortunately, what we have seen is that the original policy intent of the rebate has been compromised by claimants who were never intended to receive the rebate in recent years. This includes those who have come into the industry off the back of cheap grape prices and are now producing wine for the home brands of the retailers and receiving the rebate. That, over the longer term, does the industry no good. And we also see that the average New Zealand winery claiming the rebate, in our modelling, has a $100,000 advantage over local claimants on the rebate. That was never the intention, and in fact, it's completely in the opposite direction of that original policy intent.
Winemakers Federation of Australia Chief Executive Paul Evans speaking with Clint Jasper. And we'll have all the news for rural Australia from the federal budget as part of our Country Breakfast program next week. Bit of a change of pace now. There's been a cast of thousands flocked to the Queensland town of Rockhampton this week, all talking up the future of beef farming at home and abroad. And a big part of that future is, of course, in very small hands. Kids growing up on cattle properties around the country will ultimately shape the future of Australian beef. We headed west of Rockhampton in central Queensland, where one farming family is putting its future in the hands of their 13-year-old daughter. But Rory Fenwick isn't your typical teenager.
For 13-year-old Rory Fenwick, handling a one-ton Brahman comes naturally. She's a third-generation cattle breeder, and the business is in her blood.
This is Jess. She's my show cow. Last year, I took her to Junior Beef, and she won Junior Calf Champion. And I'm going to take her this year as well to Junior Beef. I have to tie her up every afternoon and wash her and brush her and make her quiet and get used to lots of people and different things. When we brand our calves and wean our calves every year, we all get in the pen and pick out which ones we want to take to Junior Beef. The year before that, I took her half-sister, so I wanted to take her.
Rory's used to leading the way in the show ring.
I had the bull, Megatron, and I took him to Junior Beef as well, and he sold for $60,000. He was a good bull, and he was worth it. We didn't think he'd make that much money, but...
Her parents, Will and Tracy Fenwick, beam with pride when they talk about their children. Rory's a big sister to 10-year-old Jack and 7-year-old Harry.
I mean, it's any business today. You strive to do anything for your kids. It's in her blood. You know, I mean, she does a report at school that's about cattle, and she loves it. The boys at this stage aren't as keen as her. The last couple of years, she's really showed a lot of interest in the cattle, and it's encouraged us to go stronger with our breed.
To give Rory the best opportunities for her future, the Fenwick family this year made the tough decision to send her to boarding school.
It was a change. Everyone told us it was going to be tough on us, and we thought, big tough grown-ups, we didn't think it'd be tough, but it was very tough. Losing our little girl to boarding school. You wake up in the mornings and Rory's there and full of cheek and she's not here. I mean, it's like they've vanished. But anyhow, it's only for 5 years and half she'll be home before we know it.
Rory has also struggled with the transition, but she handles it with a stoicism beyond her years.
I miss not seeing Mum and Dad every day. Well, when you wake up, you don't look outside and there's cows and grass and stuff. It's cars and roads, and it's different because, like, you don't see all your pets and stuff, and you're just with your friends all the time. sometimes you just want to go to the farm.
Rory's already thinking a lot about her future, and she's certain the cattle industry will be a big part of it. But that's not all she has planned.
I want to be a midwife and take over Fennec Brahmins. I just love babies, and Mum said that was a job that has a lot to do with babies.
Rory's very much a part of the Fennec family succession plan, but nothing has been decided for her.
I mean, that's the plan. I mean, but if Rory and the boys choose to do different paths, or so be it. Anything can happen.
My hopes for her is for her to be able to do whatever she wants to do, so long as it makes her happy. If she decides she goes to uni and does midwifing and then turns around and comes home, then I'm quite happy with that. But if she decides that midwifing is where she wants to be and she lives in the city, then I'm more than happy with that as also.
The Fennecs are under no illusions about the future of the industry and the challenges Rory will face as she grows up.
Being on the lands, it's tough. It's very tough. It all looks rosy, but there's a lot of hurdles for us real people to jump. Floods, droughts, so many hidden things. But it's all hurdling. Just keep jumping hurdles, and what they're saying, what doesn't kill you, make you stronger. I mean, we'd love for our kids to keep marching on, and their kids, but you just don't know what's around the corner. But we've got all intentions is to keep staying strong as a family and working together as a group and have great goals.
In the meantime, Rory's working on some short-term expansion plans.
Me and my brothers got money together and bought a steer. When he goes to the meatworks, that money will buy more steers. So then one day we can buy some really good heifers and bulls.
And that's 13-year-old Rory Fennec from Fennec Brahmins in central Queensland. Thanks to Megan Hendry for that story. If you missed Four Corners this week, then you missed a story that was damning of the food industry for the treatment of its workers.
All of the major suppliers are using dodgy labour hire contracting arrangements that fundamentally exploit the workers who pick and pack the vegetables that make their way onto Coles and Woolworths shelves and that consumers buy, believing that that produce is produced fairly in Australia.
It posed the scenario that very little food would actually be left on the shelves of major supermarkets were we to stamp out illegal workers. Every industry, from horticulture to chicken meat processing and the supermarkets themselves, faced serious revelations and allegations of exploitation and racial abuse.
All of the major suppliers are using dodgy labour hire contracting arrangements that fundamentally exploit the workers who pick and pack the vegetables that make their way onto Coles and Woolworths shelves and that consumers buy, believing that that produce is produced fairly in Australia.
While for many in the industry this was not a surprise, there were a range of views on what could be done to prevent it.
The Australian migrants that don't necessarily have good English, particularly if they haven't been here that long, come from often very poor backgrounds. They're not well resourced, and they often have an allegiance to, if the labour hire contractor is from their own ethnic group, they have an allegiance to them. They trust them, they speak their language, and they are very reluctant to speak out in the community. They're quite vulnerable. The program didn't touch that. And there's another group out there too, which we do hear of from time to time, and that's the illegal workers. Now, while they shouldn't be here and they need to go home, they also are very vulnerable because they can't speak out, particularly to the authorities, because obviously they're flagging themselves to be sent home.
Peter Angel runs the Harvest Labour Trail website, where about 200,000 backpackers look for work each year while they're travelling the country. And we happened to meet one of those this week, a Queensland fruit picker who has spent the past 5 years travelling around Australia working on farms. He says the Bundaberg region has a bad reputation amongst the backpacker community. Jonathan Duncan now works on his family's avocado and custard apple farm at Childers near Bundaberg and says the Four Corners program was no surprise.
There's a bit of a notion going around that's been passed on word of mouth that Bundaberg has been a very difficult place to work and make money. There seems to be a lot of things going on that aren't above board, i.e. holding onto passports and not paying pickers properly, that gets these backpackers stuck in these towns, unable to make enough money to get out.
So you heard this from foreigners working around Queensland, that there was already this issue with Bundaberg and that they were aware there was quite a significant problem there?
Yeah, well, the very first people that I travelled around with, one was from Sweden, one's from Portugal, and from Malta, and they were in Bundaberg, stuck in that problem. They couldn't make enough money to get out. The backpackers, they were holding off their money and just trickling enough out so they had to stay there and live. And I think some of them were earning $60 a week after all their expenses came out for 6 10-hour days.
And your family are local farmers as well. What's the impact of that Four Corners documentary and that story being told on the region? Does it reflect badly?
I guess it's a double-edged sword. You're always going to have that element of farmers and contractors who are going to rip people off. And it's just, how do you police that? Where do you go to start policing that?
That's one of the very questions the horticulture industry thinks it can answer.
So it would give assurance to both the grower and assurance to the worker of what they should be earning and how they should be, behaving in the orchards and the vineyards.
Tanya Chapman from industry group The Voice of Horticulture says a smart card could be the answer.
They will have been ticked off that they have the correct working visas, tax file numbers, superannuation, and all of that information will be stored on a green card. Every man and every dog basically has a smartphone that has a QR reader on it. So the ability would be able to store all of that information on their card, QR-read it. It would tell the grower that this person is right to work, but also on that card would have a little bit of information for the worker.
Back on the avocado farm near Childers, long-time farmer Tom Duncan is saddened by the Four Corners program.
I think it's a sad indictment on our industry, and it doesn't reflect the real farming community. In every business anywhere, you're going to have people that are going to exploit people, and this time it looks like some of the farmers, whether they know it or not, with this employment agencies, they've sort of passed the buck over to them to do the right thing, and it looks like it's not happening the way it should be.
So you think the farmers should take a bit of responsibility for this and say, hang on, we're equally to blame?
Yeah, I don't know whether they're equally to blame, but I think it's pretty easy to ring up and order 20 or 30 people and then just pay someone and don't have that responsibility that who you got working for you. And this is what's happened over the years, that originally farmers used to employ people, and then they found out it was easier to just ring someone up and get 30 or 40 people there for so many hours instead of them chasing people up and then doing tax files and whatever. So they've left it to these companies to do it. So it's, and the companies and some of these, and there's a lot of good companies out there as well. And it's just some of these people are just taking advantage of the system, and it's a very sad day that, you know, you just can't trust people these days.
One of the main contentions of the Four Corners program was that farmers source workers through labour hire companies, and it's those companies that are unscrupulous. The Harvest Trail's Peter Angel says it could be as simple as farmers simply talking to their workers.
Best thing they can do is actually talk to the workers themselves. We often find we've got smaller properties where the farmer is often out in the field working with the workers side by side. They'll have a bit of a chat with them, and they find that they're being underpaid or badly treated, and they're often horrified. And I've heard several stories. I spoke to a farmer in Tasmania only yesterday who told me a similar story. Once he found out what the workers were being paid, he got rid of the labour hire contractor. He took the workers on directly himself, so they were paid properly, and he had an excellent relationship with his workers. People came back in their second year, even though they didn't have to work for him or even just to visit.
And we'll leave the final word to Tom Duncan near Bundaberg, trying to run a working farm.
I feel sorry for a lot of the backpackers too, because, you know, they work, they're not used to working. A lot of these young ones come out of their last year of school, they come over to Australia. They're going to have a holiday, they do a little bit of work before they go into whatever their chosen field is, you know, and to work their butt off from daylight till dark and then end up with, you know, nothing in their hand. It's a terrible reputation on Australia as far as when they go home.
Avocado farmer Tom Duncan, and thanks to Marty McCarthy in southeast Queensland for his part in our story this morning. That's a Country Breakfast for this week. Alex Stinson took care of our technical production. If you'd like to meet some of those kids helping produce the steak on your plate, you can find our Beef Week feature online at abc.net.au/rural. You're with RN. I'm Edwina Farley. Bye for now.